Good morning, everybody. It's a little after 10. June 20th, 2024. This is a work session on case number RC-23-348. It's a case between Casey and Julie Voigt and the Coyote Creek Mining Company. But at this point, the issue really is about the attorney fee award. And so I don't have any opening comments to either of you. By the way, for the record, Commissioners Sherry Haugenhoffert and Julie Fedorchek and multiple PSC staff. In the
I don't have any opening comments.
No comments.
Okay. I'm just going to turn it over to you, Jack or Jonathan. I don't know how you want to kick it off.
Well, I can get us just give us a quick jump start, and then I could probably turn it over to Jonathan as well as Brian, because I was a little constrained on time, and I pulled him in to do some deep diving into this issue as well. So if you just to give a quick refresher recollection on how this proceeding was initiated, the Voigts filed a complaint initially on our grade approvals. It was put into state court, district court. There was some discussion between the parties, including the staff, where we all stipulated that that if they filed a complaint, that the commission accepted it and issued a decision, final determination on it, that they would dismiss the appeal. But of course, that would be subject to an opportunity to appeal on the actual record and final decision of the commission on that one. So the commission then went forward and did actually accept the complaint. We held a hearing, we issued an order, and ultimately we dismissed the complaint from the Voigts in that proceeding, finding that the mine appropriately did the grade approvals as well as was not in violation of any of the administrative rules or requirements from the permit. In our final order, we did provide a finding that at this time, due to the nature of the proceeding and how this came about, that we would not be providing attorney's fees at this time.
Were they requested, Jack?
They were not. So they were requested in the answer. They stated that they would do so in their proposed order.
Okay, you have to use non-legal terms.
Sure.
The answer.
So there was a complaint that was filed by the Voigts.
Yep.
Subsequently, there was an answer filed by the mine.
Okay.
And they did state that they would be requesting attorney's fees there.
Okay.
In fees.
And then did we talk about that at the proceeding?
We did not talk about that at the proceeding.
Okay.
So final determination was made. The order was issued. The mine then, post-order, did request attorney's fees in accordance with what is provided in statute. So that is afforded to them to make that filing and for us to take that into consideration.
So I'm sorry, Randy, do you want to jump in? Do you want to have questions like this, or how do you want to proceed?
This is fine with me.
Okay. So the line in our order that says, based upon the circumstances of the proceeding, the commission declines to assess fees, is just based on what was included in the answer?
No, that was largely based on from the discussions that we had with the commissioners, that based upon the manner in which this proceeding came to us through appeal, stipulation to hear, that at this point in time that we would not be issuing or providing attorney's fees in this case.
Okay. Talk a little bit more about the manner in which it came.
Well, as I already provided, Commissioner, there was the initial appeal, the stipulation to send it back down to, or agree to, if the commission hears it.
Yeah.
That appeal would be dismissed, and the subsequent hearing as a result of that.
Mm-hmm.
I understand all that. I just want to be clear. The Voights initially requested attorney fees, and Bass going through it. When it goes to the appeal to hear before us, that's when we issued the order saying no to the attorney fees.
It was not the Voights. It was Coyote Creek Mine.
I
do want to provide some clarification along the way. Attorney's fees has been tossed in through the appeals and a number of filings, so you'd find it scattered around, but so including from the Voights as well.
Right.
I guess I'm still stuck on why the manner in which this came about. Did we include this line in our order?
So the discussion that was, and again, this wasn't, I believe, in a work session. And maybe you, Jonathan, maybe you can provide a little bit of background on that, and then if I feel I need to add on to it as well,
okay.
I could hop back in.
Yeah, I think we added that in there because it was in Coyote Creek Mine's proposed conclusions of law, findings, and order. But it was not specifically requested because at that time you don't know if they're the prevailing party.
Right.
But once you know who the prevailing party is, once we issue the order, they have 45 days upon receipt of that order to request attorney fees, which they did.
Right. So it was preliminary.
Okay. So that this doesn't preclude the, in even when we added this, the intent wasn't to preclude them using that 45-day window.
I believe so, correct.
Looking back, I would agree that we probably should have held off on the decision on that and provided that in the order, since the there was not a conclusion at that point in time.
Okay.
However, it doesn't preclude us from looking at it now that it's been requested and arguments have been filed back and forth, correct?
Well, I will leave that up to the commission to make a determination on that.
Okay. So I think you can continue then.
Sure.
Where you left off.
That was just to give a quick brief background on that. And Jonathan, I think maybe he can give you a little more insight into the filings. And I know the research that Brian has done specifically on the attorney's fees may be valuable to you as well. And I did provide that memorandum to you. Apologize that I did forget to hit send. Even though I told you, I emailed it to all three of you. So.
Yeah, I guess I can start off about, you know, some of the issues brought up during this formal hearing. Now, mainly the issues were SPGM respread depths, kind of the pre-mine and the post-mine, respread depths, and then the coal lease was also brought up again. So this is essentially like the third formal hearing we've had with the Voights. Initially, during the permit application, and that would be case number 13-850, there was a formal hearing, and they did discuss, SPGM respread depths and spoil grade testing and the coal lease, but it just was not to the extent that it was discussed in this formal hearing. You know, both of those issues were also discussed, and I believe that was in the last renewal. That was like case number 19. I don't have it off the top of my head. So all of the issues that we did discuss during this formal hearing have been brought up in the past, but not to the extent that they were discussed. They were just more, briefly discussed, maybe for, half an hour in total or less.
They also brought up policies, too, if I recall. Updated policies, correct?
Yeah, they mentioned policy memorandum number 17.
Yep.
And in the informal, was dust brought up again?
I believe it was mentioned, but I don't think it was an issue extensively talked about.
In addition to the formal complaints or cases we've had on this, how many informal discussions back and forth have you guys had?
As far as an informal hearing or just
hearings? Yeah.
Well, since I've been here just one, but there would have been one at the time of renewal. I think it would have been in 2019 or 2020. And then I'm assuming there would have been one also in 2013 or 2014 when they applied for the permit as well.
Generally, it's a prerequisite to the formal hearing.
Right.
You might have a little more background.
Was there an informal prior to this? This one? Was there an informal?
No. This proceeding was unique.
You're right.
From that standpoint, that it wasn't regarding a permit application, renewal, or revision, and it was subsequently just an action or complaint filed to address, I guess, one or two issues relating to respread.
And is there an informal process for something like that? Could there have been an informal process for something like this? I don't understand all the processes involved in, what's available and isn't.
This one's a little more unique. It's usually, when a permit is deemed complete, there is a notice that goes out where a party may request a informal conference. And then if they request one, then they have 30 days after we issue our order to request a formal hearing. And then when we issue and approve a permit, then there's another opportunity to request a formal hearing. This complaint just went straight to a formal hearing.
This was discussed during a previous informal hearing, though. I believe Monty provided some discussion, even though I'm not sure. Maybe Monty, you can reflect on that. Was that an issue that was provided notice ahead of that informal conference, or was that just something that they were trying to wrap their head around?
Yeah, the informal conference was, it was mostly them trying to wrap their head around the difference between projected respread thicknesses and actual respread thicknesses. So it wasn't directly related to this formal hearing, but I don't know, somewhat, I guess.
Well, it had been cited in leading into it.
So in docket 124, when mine filed for fees, on page 9, I'm just going to read this. I'm wondering what their basis of this is, or if staff disagrees that the Voight's the mine says the Voight's proceeded to the formal hearing on December 22nd, 2023. The Voight's did so fully aware that the commission had previously told them that, quote, once a petition for formal hearing is received, particularly for parties with counsel, the commission will expect that such claims have a reasonable basis, be supported by sufficient allegations of facts and supporting evidence, and take care to avoid relitigation of issues. When was that? When were they made aware of that?
When
would Voight's have been made aware of that? Because they're saying they were fully aware of that.
That was during our order for the formal hearing for the last permit renewal, and that would have been case number 19-189. And case number 19-190.
Oh, I guess.
So if you look on page 6.
I guess if I'd have went further, it cites it. Sorry about that.
Sure.
I'm stuck on the processes. I almost need a timeline of the case. And when is a formal, I don't understand the administrative process well enough to be able to kind of get to the heart of what we need to determine this.
Sure.
In terms of what triggered this. There wasn't a permit renewal. There wasn't, it seems like there's certain triggering things that are provided notices, et cetera, that allow the public to engage, and how was that part of this or not part of this, and so that's what I don't understand how this all flows. Do you know what I'm saying?
I understand, and also acknowledge that this is unique. This is not how this normally flows at all, and so the part of this was resulting from the manner that it went straight to appeal. I think what may be helpful to Commissioner Fedorchak, Jonathan, is if you'd walk through where, well, maybe quickly, briefly, the permitting process and how that relates to the grade approval process, which is what they appealed, and maybe the notice requirements around that.
Yeah.
So essentially, once an area is mined, you know, the mine will backfill and grade that area to the post-mine topography, you know, using graded spoil. And once it's graded the post-mine topography, the mine will survey that area, test the spoil, and then they will submit a grade approval request. And that's that request we review to ensure that the topography matches and the SPGM respread depths proposed are consistent with our regulations. And if there's no issues after we review the request and inspect it on site, then we send them an approval letter.
So is there notices involved in this grade approval?
There are no notices involved.
There's a tight timeline of 30 days in which to approve or disapprove of it. And maybe to take a step back further, part of that is ensuring not just that it meets the regulations, but that it meets the permit requirements as well. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, that would be correct.
And so part of this goes all the way back to the initial permit, that this was reviewed at that point in time.
Okay, and decided.
Decided.
And they objected at that point. We reviewed it, like the first permit approval and then the renewal, both those times it was reviewed. We went through the formal hearing process and made a decision.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay, so this is the third one. And okay, so this, now I understand better how they're kind of mad that they weren't noticed. Well, there is no notice requirement for grade approvals.
Yeah, and all of our handling methods for SPGM and redistribution requirements have not changed since that permit was issued.
Got it.
And whose requirement is it that the grade approval requests be handled within 30 days?
That's in admin code. In administrative code, it states that.
Okay. Yep. Is that to help with the contemporaneous mining and stuff? I would assume so. Yeah. Okay. So then what sort of, when there isn't like a formal notice, et cetera, what does what administrative processes exist for folks to engage like this?
Generally, it would be, a complaint where somebody is requesting an inspection. That would have to be verbal and in writing saying, I believe, you know, there's a violation that exists, cite the specific regulations that, you know, the operator is violating. And then once we review that request, we either have to inspect the mine and that area or respond, I believe it's within maybe 15 days, as to why we did not inspect that area. And then I also believe there's another provision in, you know, citizen suits where that could, where you could implement a formal hearing, but I think that's more in district court, I believe.
So is this type of a complaint, that's what you're getting at, that's totally different?
Correct.
It wasn't that they were alleging that there was a violation, or did you kind of view this as they were alleging a violation?
No, because, well, they alleged that they were violating our regulations, or they were, you know, they did not comply with our regulations, but that they did not request an inspection. So if you request an inspection, it has to be specific.
And if you had been requested to inspect, what would that have looked like?
Well, we probably would have reviewed the request, and more than likely, we would have responded to state why we did not inspect that area.
Then what happens? If they you just dismiss it, or do you make a determination? Then can they appeal to the commission then, or at what point? How does that process carry out?
I would have to look at our rules and laws, but I believe maybe they would have to enter into a citizen suit after that point. But I can't say that for certainty.
Right. I think in the past, the view has been that if someone files a complaint with us regarding an issue under Normal Administrative Practices Act, that the commission has the authority under that section to hear a complaint if it deems appropriate. So that's not neatly tucked under Chapter 38.14.21.
Yeah. So that's how this came to be then.
This would have been more oriented in that direction, even though it is a Chapter 38.14.1 as complaint.
Okay.
So did you want to continue with background or?
Well, as far as the request for inspections?
No, I think
I'm good.
We're good on now that
the process,
the steps of the process to get here. Mm-hmm. But you were in the middle of kind of giving background when asked about that. So
okay.
If you have more that you want to share.
Yeah, essentially, you know, there's been three formal hearings, you know, like I said, during the permit application, the last renewal, and this previous formal hearing. And during all of those hearings, you know, SPGM respread depths and the co-lease were brought up. It just was not to the extent, it was not discussed as extensively as it was at this previous hearing. And it has been decided, you know, previously that the co-lease is out of our jurisdiction. You know, the only thing we really look at is there a mixing agreement and is the lease valid?
And yet it came up again.
Correct. You know, in their complaint, they allege that their co-lease requires 48 inches of SPGM to be respread.
And somewhere in here, the mine, I think, quotes or at least references Mr. Voigt as acknowledging that the lease doesn't exactly say that.
Correct.
Is there a dispute about that? I didn't go back and listen to the recording.
No, I believe when they asked Mr. Voigt about where does it state that in the lease, he could not point to a specific area of the lease.
So it keeps coming up, and no evidence is even provided that that's the case.
Correct.
Brian, maybe it'd be helpful if you provide a quick overview of some of your thoughts. I know you had reviewed the attorney's fees laws and we're kind of discussing.
Before you do that, Brian, one quick question on the SPGM. As I recall from the hearing, there isn't a lot of, like, there isn't a lot of question about how that is done. Like, you've got the methodology and it's sort of like hard and fast, and sort of the formulas for it, et cetera, just exist and you follow that. Am I remembering that correctly?
Correct.
And we've talked about those at, like, that's part of the initial permit. It's part of the renewal. It's been the way it is since the 80s.
Correct. Yeah, it hasn't changed since the 80s. You know, I think at the previous hearings, they did not discuss it in as much detail, but they did discuss it. And I even know, I believe it was in case number 13-850 during the permit application. I think they had Dr. Merrill as an expert witness, and he did talk about how he was the one who did work for the, you know, it's a part of that NDSU study, which we base all of our soil redistribution requirements on. And, you know, based on graded soil properties and all that.
During that hearing, though, were the issues the same or were they different?
Well, there were more issues.
Yeah. Okay.
This was, yeah, just a, you know, small part portion of the issues.
And was SPGM part of the discussion in any of the informal?
Yes.
Going through all that?
Yeah, the last informal we had and for revision 12, it was mainly on SPGM, well, the projected SPGM respread map, and I don't know if they talked extensively about the actual redistribution thickness and then also about variance areas and seeding, but it was discussed extensively.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing that I bring up in relation to informals is generally the view the commission and I think staff has on informals is that is a process for the public in order to be advised on something that is pretty complex. I mean, coal mining is not common sense to the vast majority of people. The regular regulatory requirements are not as well. And so when there's a concern that comes forward, that's usually the first step to learn. Obviously, maybe at times with certain parties, it's being used slightly differently. But conceptually, that's been looked at as to a degree of positive by the agency for the opportunity to learn what's going on. And preferably, the understanding will either lead the mine to make some correction as a result of that, or that the landowner would be better informed on that issue and realize that is not the issue that they thought it was.
Right.
And leading up to this case over the years, and I know, well, I guess Guy was here the whole time. not all of you were here the whole time back to original permitting. So besides the three cases you mentioned, you've had contact with Mr. and Mrs. Voigt other times too, right?
Correct, yeah. He came by the office last summer, I think maybe in September, and we sat down for maybe an hour or two discussing these same issues.
So it's not like this was the only way to get information from PSC staff.
Correct.
About how respread thicknesses are determined.
Yep, correct.
And it's in administrative law how this happens, right? Or it's a policy.
How? What happened?
The SPGM methodology.
Yeah, it is an admin code, and there are processes in how the admin code is applied during the proceeding. One of the arguments was that Mr. Voigt provided that he was under the impression that there was a 12-inch brown capping, and so he felt the sampling methods were not appropriate. It was minor and hardly discussed, but it was there. That was found by the commission to be refuted by Mr. Steffen's testimony that there was already pre-bench placed extensively at that point in time to a much deeper depth than 12 inches.
Yeah, I believe the exhibit Mr. Voigt was referencing, Don Steffen testified, I believe he said 30 to 40 feet of pre-bench material was placed over that area and is generally placed in 6 to 8 foot lifts.
Were you asking Brian to go into that?
I have one more question.
Oh, go ahead.
Sorry. So there was quite a lot of back and forth between the attorneys arguing about this being a Chapter 28-32 of the Admin Code versus Chapter 38-14.1.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that? Why were they focusing on the distinctions there?
Sure. Jonathan, I know we had a brief discussion about that. Would you like to walk through what we discussed?
Well, I know, we provide the procedures for formal hearings in 38-14.1, but we also have to comply with 28-32. And I believe that discussion was more about jurisdiction and how the complaint was filed. But I think I might defer to Jack on
gotcha. Some of that. And maybe I'll let Brian pop in on that one since he had looked it through that as well.
And I'm not real familiar with a lot of the procedure. I've been paying attention to most of it. I guess some of that argument, I think, relates to the fact that the commission is very limited in instances that it can award attorney's fees. It has to be something that's spelled out in law for us to be able to do that, and that is under Chapter 38, 14.1. It does allow the commission to get the fees.
Okay.
2832, I believe, is the Administrative Practices Act and how hearings are. So I think that has to do with the argument towards the procedure of how this all came about, which I haven't spent a lot of time looking into that issue. I was more focused on whether or not we are allowed to give attorney's fees and what the criteria that the commission would need to look at for that.
And let me, before you get into the to your memo, does it matter whether this was filed as a petition or a motion? It seems like there's a big hullabaloo about whether it was a petition or a motion.
I guess, again, that's an issue that I didn't really spend a lot of time looking at. I don't think it really matters. I think that the issue falls under 38, and I think that the commission does have the ability to either say yay or nay to granting attorney's fees in this case.
Okay.
So we'll probably need to dig into that 2832 versus 38-14 one a little bit more, because it does seem to be an issue that they're arguing a lot about.
Yes.
Or else just have a, I'd like a better explanation of how this all fits within 38-14.1, and which is the one that allows the attorney's fees.
We can follow up with you on that one.
Okay.
So Jack had asked me to look into attorney's fees and, you know, how the courts and the other entities look at attorney's fees and what the criteria is to determine when they should be awarded, when they should not be awarded. So the first thing I did, of course, is, you know, just because both parties were arguing that attorney's fees can be granted for either side, I did look, and it is clear that between the North Dakota Century Code and our admin code, this is an instance where the commission is able to determine if attorney's fees are appropriate and award them or not award them if they don't feel it's appropriate. So after making that determination, and I guess I should point out that the authority to grant that comes from 38-14.1-36 and also North Dakota Administrative Code 6905.20107, which is our administrative code.
So, Brian, in determining that, you've kind of determined that, I think, brought and argued that they brought it under the admin code 28-32. You believe that that's not a reasonable interpretation, that it clearly falls under the 38-14. I'm not saying I think you're wrong. You've stated that it clearly we can provide attorney's fees. So I'm just confirming then that
you've
sided with that belief that this is being brought under, that the whole thing was brought under 38-14.1, not the admin 28-32.
I believe so, because it expressly says in 1605.2.107, any person may file a petition for award of costs and expenses, including attorney's fees, reasonably incurred as a result of participation in any administrative proceeding under North Dakota Century Code Chapter 38-14.1 or this article, which results in a final order being issued by the commission.
Okay, good.
So I do believe, I think it fits under mining 3814. And I think that, you know, the discussion moving forward, I'll look into that again just to double check and make sure I didn't miss something there. But if it doesn't fall under 3814.1, then I don't believe the commission would have the ability to award attorney's fees. That would have to be by the court. Almost every other section of our century code and rules does not allow us to award attorney's fees, only, but they can be sought in the court upon appeal.
And so when we did our order, I was thinking more about the details of the order than the attorney fees. But I guess what part of what I think made me feel like that was such a logical thing to have there just has to do with the timing. And so I'm not understanding what the legislature's intent is with timing of these kinds of things. So I would have presumed, I guess if I were the one down, if I was still back down there and had the only vote and I was figuring out how to do the possibility for attorney fees, it would seem to me that would be determined when everything is finalized at the highest level I'm allowing this to go. And they've chosen to make our decisions appealable to district court. They've chosen to make district court decisions appealable to the Supreme Court. So I guess if for us to award the attorney fees, it almost seems like the timing would be when the clock has run out and someone has decided to accept our decision and not appealing it to court. Or at the next step, when the court has made a decision, their clock has run out for appealing to the Supreme Court. But as long as the legislature has said there are potentially additional steps, is it ever proper to determine that attorney fees get awarded because something was, you know, filed improperly or something?
And that's actually an interesting point to bring up. And quite honestly, I had not thought about, and not to put Brian on the spot, but I know you put a little more thought into this as well. So the period of notice of appeal is to file it is within 30 days. They can file the petition within 45 days. And is it your interpretation that you can request these attorney's fees from the court as well?
I believe so.
Okay.
I don't think anything. So if we grant them, that's something that they could be part of the appeal as well. When they appeal the decision of the commission, I believe they would be able to address our granting or denying in whichever side. And I'm going to guess one side or the other, no matter what we decide, is going to address that on appeal. And at that case, the court could say that we were wrong and reverse our decision. And I don't know that they would kick it back down for that. They would probably just make a determination, or they would agree with us and it would stand.
Right. In the event that they agree, if a party had requested the attorney's fees on the appellate level during that period of time, do you believe the court could then address it under 3814.136? And I'm assuming it'd be...
Say that again, Jack, that question.
I was thinking in relation to the timing. So if you could have the court provide you the attorney's fees and issue them, that arguably if you were going to request attorney's fees within 45, you have 45 days to do it, you will know that appeal will be filed before those attorney fees are requested. And if it is appealed, would you be able to request those attorney's fees from the court on appeal? If you need more time to think about it, it was a novel thought to me.
It is interesting, and it that may be why this is the one area of law that again, just kind of my initial thoughts that that might be intentional, that we award them here. And I'm not sure how that would play through the process of the appeal. I guess I haven't thought about that.
So maybe we could follow up with you on that.
Could you read that, what you read previous?
Sure. Any person may file a petition for an award of costs and expenses, including attorney's fees, reasonably incurred as a result of participation in any administrative proceeding under North Dakota Century Code Chapter 3814.1 or this article, which results in a final order being issued by the commission.
And that's from our admin code, but under 3814.136, North Dakota Century Code, it provides the attorney's fees for administrative proceedings and also provides that in court, in issuing any final order pursuant to 2832, in a review of a commission proceedings under this chapter, they may assess the costs, including attorney's fees, against the party whenever the court finds this appropriate. And that's what triggered, I guess, that question that I had.
Sure. And as far as the Century Code, I think that states that to a permittee from any person where the permittee demonstrates that that person initiated a proceeding under North Dakota Century Code Section 3814.130 or participated in the proceeding in bad faith to harass or embarrass the permittee.
It doesn't, nowhere does it talk kind of about the timing that Randy was thinking through.
Right, and I guess I was saying, it seemed to me, Commissioner, that you were saying this issue is continuing to be determined now at the appellate level by the courts. Is it appropriate for the courts to address the attorney fee issue? Did I understand that correctly?
Okay, that one option, okay. Or is it appropriate for us to determine it at this level?
Sure.
After everything is finalized in court.
Right. And then
right now, we have made a decision on this case. And I at least still firmly stand behind it and believe we're right. But a court has the authority to overrule or supersede or whatever mm-hmm. the word is, our decision. Well, if I determine that attorney fees should be awarded here, but then a court surprises me and overrules our decision, well, then maybe it wasn't appropriate to have given attorney fees. So I guess one of the questions was, and you've pretty well answered this, yes, they could pursue it through the court. The second one is, wouldn't it be more appropriate if we're going to make the decision at least up to this point? Because we wouldn't be deciding about attorney's fees in the district court level or the Supreme Court level. It would be just up for this part to wait until the courts are done and then answer that question.
I can't disagree with you. I don't, I'm trying to think of if when I was doing my research for this, if I came across, there's not a lot a lot of case law in North Dakota anyway, for cases where an administrative agency has awarded attorney's fees. Most of the case law that exists on these types of cases our family law cases and other things, which does give us the framework that and the basis to determine which fees are appropriate, not appropriate, and if they are appropriate or not as well. So that was a little different when I was looking at this. Our orders are all appealable, so if we stick with our original order and say, you know, no attorney's fees are awarded, I would assume that is an issue that on appeal the court could say. I don't know if they would look at it or not, and how they would look at it. I really would have to look into that a little bit further. So I apologize that I hadn't thought that through.
part of me sort of likes us making the decision on attorney's fees at our level for this part of the case, because we have the knowledge of this process, which includes interaction with the complainants when they've, you know, outside of the cases, when they've come to discuss these issues. Just to go on and on and on. I don't know if the court know all that, so it seems like it's sort of appropriate for us, but almost like early for us to include that.
I know if we did award attorney's fees, and that was challenged in the district court, I believe they would go through the reasoning and determine whether or not those fees were appropriate and could either throw it back down to us, or which I assume they would do. But I think they could make decisions on those issue at the district court level as well. I can't disagree that if we do award attorney's fees, that there is a process that we have to determine: is it all fees? Is it some? That we have to almost go through, or we do have to go through what fees have been requested, and determine whether or not they're appropriate or not. And there is framework in the law and in case law to help us and guide us in that decision as well.
Sorry, it's kind of hard for you to walk through your memo when we keep interrupting.
No, that's okay. I don't have to walk through it necessarily, line by line. But when I started looking into it, and it's not an issue that I've really spent a lot of time on before, so it was kind of fun to dig into something new. Generally, a party's costs are borne by that party. That's the general principle in case law and in jurisprudence that exists. But obviously we know that the awarding of attorney's fees exists, so that was kind of my next step, was to look into, okay, how do you decide if they're appropriate or not? And I really, I think it was in 38... The portion in 38.14.130. For the commission to award attorney's fees in this, it has to be shown that the person initiated a proceeding under the Century Code 38.14.130 or participated in the proceeding in bad faith to harass and embarrass the permittee. So first they determined, in this instance, the commission can, it's appropriate for them to determine whether attorney's fees are appropriate or not appropriate, and then starting to look into, okay, how do we determine if they're appropriate or not appropriate? So the law talks about bad faith, harass and embarrass. So I started digging into what is bad faith, what is harassment, and those kinds of things. So I found some case law that deals with what's good faith, not good faith, to help with that. There's other words that come up in my research too, things that are related to other cases involving attorney's fees. The word frivolous was discussed. I think that would be... would fall under the category of bad faith. So if it's a bad faith to harass or embarrass, something that would be frivolous would also fit underneath there. So frivolous claims are those which have such a complete absence of actual facts or law that a reasonable person could not have expected that a court would render judgment in that person's favor. So I guess that would be, does the commission feel that the void's bringing forward a claim on respread debts, which is not even something that we determine whether the law was followed, not whether or not, and that it was done according to the law with the sampling and the respread and the regrading and all that stuff. So I guess, we would look at it as, was there complaint something that a normal person or a general member of the public would see as something that wasn't right, appropriate, that there was, that there's something wrong with it. And I guess whether or not it makes sense to argue that or to bring a suit forward. I guess I don't really have any good examples of what that might look like, but as I kind of continued on looking for what's going to help the commission decide whether they're bad faith, harass, embarrass. I guess that kind of followed out. The court has a discretion to determine whether the claim is frivolous and how much to award. And I think that could be, is how it is for the commission as well. The commission has a discretion to determine whether this claim is, you know, brought under bad faith or to harass, and what costs would be awarded. So I see that paralleling and fitting in with the decision you guys will have to make here. Harassment, I couldn't find anything that really discussed harassment. There was something that came up from a federal civil rights case that did discuss harassment and embarrassment. It's kind of written similar. A prevailing defendant may recover attorney's fees only when the plaintiff's suit is vexatious, frivolous, or brought to harass or embarrass the defendant. In other words, the defendant may be awarded fees only when the plaintiff's underlying claim is frivolous, unreasonable, or groundless, or the plaintiff continues to litigate after it has clearly become so. So I thought that there was some good language in there that that helps, that would be helpful for the commission in determining this. You know, again, frivolous, unreasonable, groundless, it all gives, I guess, a little bit different language and helps a little bit in that determination. There's also abuse of process, which, again, I think kind of fits in underneath the harassment, annoying. Somebody using the process to basically just be a problem to the other party. So I included some information on that. But I think what I found was really helpful was a case from Lucas v. Riverside Park Condominium Unit Owners Association. Again, very different parties than we have here, but it said a court should not use the wisdom of hindsight to determine whether claims are frivolous. This court has ruled, and this is the Supreme Court talking, this court has ruled that district courts have abused their discretion in awarding costs and attorney's fees for frivolous claims in cases in which the law is complex, unclear, or unsettled, or in which substantial legal issues have not been decided in North Dakota because those circumstances make it more likely that a party might reasonably expect to prevail on a claim. Then I take that as the court saying, like, look, we don't want to stop people from litigating and having creative legal arguments and things like that. But there's a line in the sand, obviously, somewhere where you cross that. And that's what these court cases kind of try to help us figure out, is where that line in the sand is at. And I mean, you're going to have arguments from the voids and you're going to have arguments from the mind that it is or is not these things. But that's...
And would a distinction between what we have in front of us and that be that in that case, whoever was the person that brought the case,
mm-hmm.
they didn't have access to a district court staff that was open and willing to discuss these issues over the years. They probably hadn't had two other cases on the same topic before that district court. And so it seems like that's a pretty big distinction between that case, what I learned from your little assessment of it,
mm-hmm.
to this case.
I think so. I think the court is wary to get into territory where people are going to be afraid to bring a claim forward for fear that they're going to have to pay the other party's costs. And I think they're trying to apply and are applying a reasonableness standard here. That, you know, if there are questions of law, things that are undecided, complex, unclear, unsettled, and there are areas of law that aren't completely settled and are constantly evolving and changing, the court wants to not penalize or put fear into people from bringing those claims forward. So I guess when I read this, I think the way that I would see the commission looking at it is, do you think that this respread depth, idea, what they're appealing, is that complex area of law? Is it unclear? Is it unsettled? Are there substantial legal issues around it that it was good that the complainant brought it forward in this case or not? I thought this little section there really was probably one of the closest things I could find to something that would aid the commission in making a decision, because I think it wraps up the frivolous and harassment and all that kind of things, and it really gives you the framework of, okay, is this something that, it is cut dried? It's plain to see that when you go to do respread depths, you're going to sample, you're going to do this, you're going to do your grading, and there's a chart that says this is what your respread depths are. So I think the commission really needs to, or will need to, decide if that's complex, unclear, or unsettled. So again, abuse of process is, I think, kind of when they drafted the language in 38.14.30, participate in the proceeding in bad faith to harass or embarrass the permittee. I think that actually probably could be construed to include abuse of process as well. An abuse of process occurs when a person uses a legal process, whether criminal or civil, against another primarily to accomplish a purpose for which it is not designed. The two essential elements of abuse of process claims are an ulterior purpose and a willful act in the use of the process not proper in the regular conduct of the proceeding. I guess I don't know. I don't see any real abuse of process here. I think there was a little bit of a misstep in filing it in district court before we had a hearing here. If I remember right, they filed the appeal in district court to ask a hearing. I guess when I looked at our framework and everything, the next step for them was to request a hearing with us. But I don't see that as being an abusive process. I think it was just a different track that this case took. Overall, I believe the commission has the authority in this case to grant or deny the attorney's fees. And the criteria in here is, I believe, what the commission has at its disposal to make a well-reasoned and substantiated decision as far as, if attorney's fees are awarded or not. I think that the framework from my memo gives you the ability to make determinations either way that would be supported by the court if the decision was appealed.
So you talked about that abuse of, however you stated that.
Abuse of process.
I already asked one of you this, but I haven't forgotten the answer, but I'm curious what others thought too. When the process played out to file for a formal hearing here, without having the quote in front of me, it's listed in here, but that the agreement was if the commission would grant the request for a formal hearing and adjudicate it and make a decision, that the Voits would file to have their court case dismissed. Is that a fair explanation. Okay. Was it everybody's understanding that then they would file to have it dismissed just under the presumption that they win, but then if they lose, they're right back in court again? Or was it the understanding that they were agreeing to kind of abide by our decision after a formal hearing?
I know you already have my answer, so I'm assuming you're talked about.
Right. Yeah. I haven't heard your answer, though, and I'm very curious about that question myself, because it was kind of, you know, left open.
Sure. So my perspective on it is that when they dismissed that appeal, is that in the acceptance of the commission complaint is that they would be making it, we would be making an appealable record.
I don't.
So, yeah, I'm not saying we anticipated we'd get appealed, but that there would be an opportunity to appeal our decision.
Okay. So that in dropping their first complaint to the district court, they weren't saying what Randy said, that they would go through this process and agree with whatever decision was made.
That's not what I picked up from it.
Okay.
And that wasn't my impression either. My impression was it was an issue that, I'm not saying it was inappropriately before the district court, but there was a very limited record on it. So the agreement would be to drop the appeal, send it back down, create a record. And I guess I didn't think that anybody was agreeing that that was going to be the end of it at that point. I always assumed that there could potentially be an appeal that came after that as well.
In agreement between the Voids and Coyote, were we involved?
Mm-hmm. We were a party to the appeal, and so we also signed on to that stipulation.
Yeah, and I would agree too that, you know, in the appeal they had in district court, there really was no record. You know, and probably eventually the courts probably would bring it back to us and say we need to develop that record, but I assumed it would probably get appealed.
Sure.
Okay. I mean, why would they drop that? I mean, what would the alternative have been? Just continue going through that court and then come back and
pursue the appeal, and either the court would say there is no opportunity, there is no remand down, or yes, there's a remand down to be heard. And I'm not so confident that we would have ultimately would have been remanded back down to us. I mean, that would probably be an issue of dispute. But I think all the parties agreed that if you're, it would be preferable that there would be a record upon which a decision be made. But admittedly, I think when discussions with staff, there was the impression that this is complex and maybe there's just a misunderstanding. And once it was well explained that it probably would not be an issue that needed to move forward.
Mm.
But the Voids did feel differently about that.
So I want to go back to the end of your memo, the conclusion area.
Sure.
But in this case, we've had three cases that have involved respread to some extent or another, as well as the other discussions with staff and the parties. Claim that there's a requirement in the contract, which really isn't jurisdictional to us, but then also apparently, according to the mine, being on the record is saying that, well, it's not so clear in the contract. I could almost read into that a desire to get 48 inches, whether that's the rule or whatever, but that's what someone really, really wants. Now I'm going to jump to the last paragraph, and I'm not going to read the whole sentence because it's a longer sentence than I use.
Sure.
So starting in the middle, given the history of complaints and litigation brought forward by the Voids it may be useful to determine if there is an ulterior motive attempting to obtain a collateral advantage. Now, did I shorten that so much that I'm mischaracterizing the thought? But that's almost what it sounds to me like here.
I don't think so. You know, I don't think that the history it's not a huge part of this case, but it is a part of this case. These respread depths have been brought up multiple times, and I, as far as I know, I don't think they've ever changed from the initial. There was a case by the Voits that was, you know, appealed early on, and it ran all the way to the Supreme Court. I guess part of me wonders, was this not an issue that they should have included in that case at that time and brought it forward? You know, when you look at the history of the complaints and everything, there gets to be kind of a single issue brought up. And it seems like there's a continuing of some issues that maybe should have been addressed before. So I guess my thoughts there was, is the complaint history and the history of the Voits, does that help, or does that, would the commission, I guess I laid it out there for the commission to determine whether or not they thought that that was an act of harassment. Because if you remember when I go back to, or when I talked about abuse of process, a willful act, not in the proper course of the regular conduct, if you look at the history as a whole, that maybe starts to come in to be a little bit more clear of, and I think I'm trying to see where the other one, or there was another part where it says that you continue on with litigation when you know that it's frivolous at that point. Like there's, and that's not a real real easy thing to define or articulate, but basically the history between the mine and the Voits might go to show some sort of abusive process if a person's going to bring a single issue and in front of the commission and then let that resolve and then come back and be like, now there's another issue. Now there's another issue. And I think what's slightly complicated with that is the fact that these permits are revised and brought up time and time again. So I don't really know that the fact that it's brought up now rather than before is a super strong determining factor, but I think it's something that was worth at least noting.
You want to provide one clarification, because I don't believe the SBGM has been brought up three times. I mean, it's been brought up many times in discussion with staff. But again, that's something that I think staff has always viewed at as when landowners have questions, they take the time to try to advise them, and that's encouraged, yeah, not harassment, right? The SBGM issue, I believe, has been brought up formally twice. Okay. In the initial one, the initial application back in 13850, and then in the most recent proceeding, for what value that provides to you. And I, off the top of my head, I don't remember how it was discussed in 13850. I don't know if either any of the staff has a recollection. I know the vast majority of us weren't around at that time, besides Mr. Welsh. So I was hoping that you had some background on it, but we might need to go back and take a closer look at that, because there, I know we had some discussion about, I guess, the concept of administrative res judicata before as well.
Well, can I jump in here?
Absolutely.
Regardless of how many times we've gone through it, which is important, I'm not going to disagree with that. Is there a question of law in that? I mean, it's in the rules. The rules exist. They've been explained. There was no request to change the rules that I'm aware of. And that's how you can, that's the only way to change what we do is to change the rules that govern what we do. So that's where I'm confused in terms of like, yeah, we've been through this. You guys went through it informally. Explained it all. I don't know where the question of the law is in that.
I think the, well, if you would, on appeal currently, the question of the law, as the voids have expressed it, is the 12-inch sampling depth.
The what?
The 12-inch sampling depth. And so that was an issue that was gently brought forward at the proceeding, but it was there. And that is not, what is the appropriate sampling is not expressly provided in administrative code. But that has been something that has been determined by the commission. With 12-inch, considering the manner of how reclamation is conducted to be an appropriate sample.
Do we have a policy memo on that? Is that the policy memo that exists?
Correct. Yeah, and that was added in, I believe, in the late 80s, right after we changed our SPGM redistribution requirements.
Yeah. So we went through that in the hearing. In our hearing.
Yes.
Yeah. Was that part of your informal discussions with them, this 12-inch sampling depth?
I can't recall if we explicitly said 12 inches, but I think we did provide them a copy of Policy Memo 17, which states that. We were just more explaining the overall process on how you project SPGM respread thicknesses and then how that compares to what you actually respread after reclamation.
The 12-inch sampling depth, how does that relate to this 48-inch desire for the SPGM?
Well, essentially, if the graded spoil is of really good quality, you know, within that 12-foot sampling depth or 12-inch sampling depth, then that's assumed that's going to act as like the root zone. Then you're going to respread 24 inches SPGM. But what Mr. Voigt's claiming is saying, well, you only have 12 inches of good quality material, and below that it's highly sodic spoil.
Oh, yeah.
But at the hearing, you know, it was testified that that higher quality pre-bench overburden or spoil is respread in lifts of 6 to 8 feet at a time.
We could follow up with you and give you a full explanation on that. I know it's been a little while since we've discussed mm-hmm. it.
Any other questions? I have one, but it's a sort of a summarial thing. So I'm curious between Guy and Monty, anything that you've heard that, you know, you might... being not the one talking and not the one listening that you think we might be misunderstanding or that you think should be discussed.
You know, I think when you go back to the original informal conference, informal hearing when this permit was issued, and the voice brought up a number of issues of concern, and restoring productivity is been there. This issue ties to that, but it was never discussed to the detail that was at this last formal hearing.
So as we contemplate, did you have something else?
I did want to note that all those discussions with avoids, there was not legal staff available. We weren't there during those discussions as well, so yeah. That's why we didn't have much input.
So if one wants to look at it as a mixed bag, did the mine seek a certain dollar amount? If they did, I didn't highlight that. Is that clarified, or is that something that would be determined?
I thought there was something, because I remember an argument from the Voigt stating that it was
And I don't really need it, but so whatever that dollar amount is, does the code clarify for us? Is that an up or down decision for us? Or is there an option to say that, and I'll just use an example, not that this is my opinion on it, but let's say you thought that, well, there should have been this hearing and there was legal fees associated with doing that, and that was all appropriate, but it got way out of hand when you're continuing to bring up old stuff that's already been discussed, when you bring in neighbors to talk about situations where there was mine activity by a different mine, but that neighbor probably doesn't even know that here we're talking about SPGM respread, which didn't even apply to his situation. There's so much extra brought in. So I guess my question is a partial award
sure
a possibility or appropriate?
So in our administrative code, if they file a petition for award of cost of expenses, there needs to be an affidavit setting forth detail all costs and expenses, including attorney's fees reasonably incurred for or in connection with participation in the proceeding, receipts, but then it says further down, number five, appropriate costs and expenses, including attorney's fees, may be awarded. My assumption is the commission would determine what is appropriate and what isn't.
Is that in courts in general, when attorney's fees are awarded, is the common thing that it's all or nothing, or is it usually some parts?
No, I've seen cases where a party will ask for something and the court looks at it and they're like, no, and we'll grant you award in this dollar amount. I think the one I was thinking there was a child custody family law case where they did award fees, but they did not award the full amount. And that's fairly common that the court will take a look at them and make a determination on what is reasonable.
I'm going to look to Monty, Jonathan, Guy. Working with these permits and the revisions and the process, I mean, it seems like when there's a revision, it opens up the door to communication and all that. So it's very complex in some ways, you know, this whole process and mining and going back to the landowner. So where in this process could things be done differently to, you know, as far as if a person has concerns, you know, work with a company, work with a PSC. I mean, it's just...
Yeah, we've had a lot of communication with the Voits. I know after the last informal conference we had with them, we did agree to copy them on all correspondence, you know, with permit revisions as far as, you know, giving them a copy of the revisions. And then if they're significant, you know, that require notice, obviously they would, you know, the Voits would receive that notice as well, so they're aware of what's going on.
I think that one, and this is just a general sentiment that I have, one thing that's difficult with these is that frequently I think the Voits are seeing the deficiencies that we write, which are usually late in the process, and that is what focuses them on a certain issue, because it's something that maybe we are observing and are already we view addressing. And as we move forth, it all ends up in a very compressed process at the end of the permitting within the timeline and deadlines. And if you guys feel differently, please, you know, tell me. But it, again, stepping in usually toward in the latter in the process, that's how it seems to me.
Yeah, I would tend to agree. You know, but part of the issues that the Voits brought at this formal hearing, they were already in the permit, and that's you know, how we've been mining and reclaiming land since, you know, the late 80s. Mm-hmm. So it's not like our methods have changed recently.
Mm-hmm. But Guy said it was never discussed in detail like this before until the formal hearing.
Correct. Yeah, it was briefly discussed, but not to this extent.
Formally. But yeah. Informally, did you walk through all the processes or not?
Yes. Probably different aspects of it.
I mean, as you described, that informal process is the opportunity to learn. There's back and forth. You could ask questions. That's where, I mean, it seems like that would be a much more productive way to learn about the process versus the formal hearings that we have.
Even probably the informal, outside the informal conference would even be preferable because
right.
Informal conferences are usually supposed to be, and we've seen it in a lot of places where it can be very constructive, but it does seem that it almost seems like pre-litigative litigation and in some of these, and that makes it a little more difficult to a degree.
Well, and the desire for the 48 inches, I mean, when you look at some of the criteria for unreasonable is one of them, I mean, there isn't enough topsoil, and there isn't just enough to make that possible. So that seems unreasonable to me, the 48 inches, which I'm sure was described to them in the informal process and throughout this discussion that, you know, you can't make more soil. What are you going to bring it in from someplace else, or how would you even make that happen, the 48 inches?
Yeah, I would agree. You know, I know what section one, you know, I think on average only has, what is it, got maybe 6 inches of topsoil?
It's a total of 17 inches.
Yeah. Yeah, a total of 17 inches of SPGM. So in our, the least amount of respread we allow is, you know, 24 inches with 1 foot of high, at least 1 foot of high quality overburden. So in the end, you're going to receive more SPGM than, you know, what was there pre-mine.
So the question to me comes, like, how much of this was known ahead of time and then still brought forward through this formal, time-consuming, expensive process for our agency, for everybody involved? How much was known ahead of time and is baked into the administrative process that just exists as is and has been for years? And it wasn't going to change as a result of this process. That's not how you change these kinds of operational procedures.
I think one thing is to say it's known. It's another thing to say it's understood. I mean, that's probably a difference. I know sometimes things get explained and then someone walks away thinking they understand it, but they have really no real understanding of what they're talking about. And staff probably could speak the interactions to a degree, but
and to your point, Jack, based on your statement you just made, is that why the agreement was made to proceed to the formal hearing versus knowing and understanding and not go right to the district court? What was the basis for the agreement then?
There are a number of factors, but ultimately the first thing that I think I looked at was that the requested remedy was a hearing. And my thought was, well, why didn't you just request a hearing? And then, you know, that instead
of... So it's more procedurally.
It seemed like the obvious step. Why are we going to go to appeal to have a hearing without actually someone requesting a hearing?
I think, too, that if it was to proceed with an appeal through district court and not just requesting for a hearing, the district court would have gotten that, and they're like, there's no record here. Right. What do you want us to do? And they would have sent it back down to us for a hearing.
Possibly.
Or we would have had to have the hearing at the district court level.
Or procedurally dismissed too. Yeah. Who knows? But
other questions?
Now, anyway.
If not, staff will be here, but this, you know, this is our chance to discuss it with each other and stuff. So,
sorry, and we can follow up with some of these discussions after the fact as well.
Okay. I need some further advice. I think we reconvene at 12 o'clock for the Otter Tail case, right?
Yep. Yes. The input. Yep.
Where do you envision this going next, Randy, as portfolio holder?
I don't know. I have a lot of information to digest, so I don't really know or have a plan.
All right.
Okay. Thanks, everybody.